case, which is case number 58724, Moshe Elazar versus John Berry. Mr. Henrich, you may proceed. Mm-hmm. And would you like to reserve some time for rebuttal?
Yes, please, Your Honor. If I may reserve 4 minutes.
Yes, thank you.
So if you may please report, Joel Henrich, on behalf of the defendant appellant, Moshe Elazar. Mm-hmm. This appeal concerns the post-judgment award of attorney's fees. We did not appeal from the underlying judgment. Mm-hmm. A defendant submits that the district court abused its discretion with respect to two of the factors under Beatty. I think stemming particularly from errors in law in deciding what the legal framework was for determining those fees. So the major issue this case deals primarily, I think, with the fourth Beatty factor, whether or not the amount of fees was reasonable and justified in the amount. Specifically, I think here, whether a contingency fee analysis is appropriate in the limited context of Rule 68. This is an important question that requires clarification from the court. Let me cut to the quick. Contingency fee calculations are not appropriate in the limited context of Rule 68 and NRS 17-115. Most importantly, because in that context, fees are not awarded for the entirety of the litigation. There is, in the Rule 68 context, this peculiar timing aspect where fees are only awarded after the offer is rejected. So in this sense, it is different than fee provisions in contracts or fee shifting statutes, as in Chapter 40 that was addressed in Schuette v. Beezer, where the fees are awarded for the entire litigation.
Is there a way, assuming you could receive, it's an interesting question, if you could receive a contingency fee that's recoverable under Beatty, is there a way to prorate it based on the 10 days after the offer of judgment expires and do some sort of calculation?
Calculation, maybe saying, well, it was 3 years, it was offered 1 year into that, so we'll cut it by a third.
I don't know if that would be the formula, but I mean, some mathematical way to deal with that the 10 days after the offer is not accepted, you know.
I think that is conceivable. There is no notion from the district court's order that was a deliberate decision in this case in reaching the result here. If it is possible, I think the better course, followed by the California courts and a number of courts across the country, is to, when you don't have that entire litigation, and because it would require a significant amount of arbitrary line drawing to try to make use of the contingency analysis as a starting point, that the courts favor requiring both parties to do the lodestar approach, and then, as the California court did in Ketchum, you could always, if you had exceptional cases that were really contingent, where there was really doubt, you could then add contingency modifiers.
Is the California authority and the other related jurisdictions that you reference considered a majority position?
No. Although Nevada is already in the minority when it comes to offering fees in the Rule 68 context at all.
In many ways, yes.
Yeah. Usually that penalty is cost, there are interest issues involved, but not fees in most cases. So
Right.
And I'm not saying that it is error to award them. I'm just talking about when it comes to deciding whether or not there is any of these cases that represent the majority approach, I don't think that it really would be possible to find that. I think that we can just look to the analysis that will be most helpful to the court. The court's here, and I think ought to be adopted by the court. But as a policy matter, I think that there are other reasons why contingency analysis is not well suited to the offer of judgment context. As a policy matter, if a plaintiff is able to recover fees for the litigation, regardless of when during the course of litigation that offer is extended, then I think there is less incentive to offer it long before trial. And so if the purpose is to resolve cases earlier on, I don't think that the contingency analysis serves that purpose well. I think it's also worth noting that there are different public policy considerations involved in Rule 68 and NRS 17-115, and I'll just refer to that as Rule 1 or Rule 68 going forward, than there are normal fee-shifting statutes. Most of the time when we see fee-shifting statutes, it is because there is some societal interest in furthering the litigation, even though the potential recovery may be small. So class action, lawsuits, consumer construction defect, deceptive trade practices acts, these are cases where we as a society have an interest in those cases going forward, but the amounts that might be recovered make it difficult to find an attorney on the open marketplace of legal services to actually pursue those cases. And so we award for the entire litigation. That's not the case with Rule 68. The purpose of Rule 68 is not to give someone essentially free litigation because they make an offer early on. The idea is to incentivize people to offer and accept with a penalty. And here, if you had a lodestar analysis, it not only is fair to both parties, because the defendant is never going to be able to slip in more than a lodestar, but that penalty here in this case, $433,000, which was the lodestar amount, it is more than enough to incentivize. So you have that, you have the vastly different penalties for the defendant. Again, the defendant capped at lodestar here, about $433,000, where you have a plaintiff who, if a contingency basis is used, might benefit to the extent of $1.2 million. And again, I think that if the court were to adopt the lodestar approach for this limited context, I don't think it would have to reverse Schutte v. Beezer or the other cases that have allowed the district court's discretion to start with either. But in this limited context of Rule 68, the court could also advise that there are the possibility of contingency enhancements when that's necessary in truly exceptional cases. And why truly exceptional? Because as a number of the courts, the federal courts, have pointed out, U.S. Supreme Court cases in Daigle and Burlington, the lodestar already accounts for the most part for the difficulties that are involved in recovering in the case. Mr. Gans, I think, is worth $550 an hour because of his experience and expertise. But because of that experience and expertise that you are paying for in the $550 an hour rate, there is not much question left in your case that there is going to be success. Mr. Edwards, when he doesn't charge a contingency, charges almost $1,000 per hour because he always wins. And so that is typically included in the lodestar.
Hey, yes, that's when Mr. Posenberg charges, so I like that, but never mind.
Yeah, we do that. They'll always win.
Go ahead.
Okay, so unless the court has any questions on that particular issue.
Was there an interest, was there an issue regarding interest, prejudgment interest on future damages?
I raised that in the opening brief. I did not appreciate the extent to which that had been waived in the district court, and so I withdraw that. I did not.
Well, we've heard from Mr. President recently that interest, so I was kind of seeing if I had a new take on this.
And I was here for that last week, although I would say that I don't think he conceded that particular point about interest on interest.
No, I understand.
Go ahead.
Okay.
As a general rule, I think the court should clarify, the bar would benefit from the court clarifying that in this context, contingency fees are just ill-suited. And here it led to an absurd result. We had a lodestar analysis, which is the time actually spent by the value of that time. It was a sizable amount, and the award that was given was 2.6 times that in a case where liability was conceded and where past damages were conceded, so that the only question going forward was the amount of future damages and pain and suffering.
I hear the argument being raised today that by some of the concessions of the district court, you compromise today because Gonzalez was really not articulating well in the position of your client.
Not your
position, position of client before the district court, and conceding at some points in their arguments on the sort of wins on factors.
I would say that I think of the four factors, the record on this factor was stated the most plainly, that the contingency fee should not have been used, that the lodestar was appropriate. I don't think there was any ambiguity about that. I do think, and I'll go ahead now and use that to segue into the third factor, which is whether or not the rejection, whether or not the offer was rejected in bad faith or unreasonably. We did concede that on factor number two, that was reasonable to the extent that all that factor means, assuming all that factor means is the amount that is offered and the evidence that supports that amount at the time is less than the foreseeable amount of a potential verdict. And on that analysis, I don't think we can test that. We still don't. There is the other issue, the other aspect, I think, that is a legitimate consideration of whether or not the offer was accepted or rejected, and that is the ability to pay. I don't think that is a factor in and of itself. I think it should be considered, and in that respect, the second factor and the third factor are really two sides to the same coin, but on the third factor, we did make a clear record. And just there, I think the reason that it ought to be a factor is because this court has on several occasions talked about Rule 68 in terms of settlement. And what is the this was in the Clark v. Lubitz case, in the Dillard Department Stores v. Beckwith that had affirmed then District Court Judge Gibbons on upholding the fee award. And now, even in the Civil Practice Manual, it echoes the statements of this court that offers of judgment are vehicles for settlement. Settlement connotes an agreement, a contract. And you does not enter a contract with a bad, without a good faith intent to perform.
But are you imposing an outcome on the other party that they're not legitimately allowed to decide? Is that an offer they want to accept based upon, as we stand here, exceeding the insurance policy?
I think that there are two ways to handle that. Actually, three. First, let me clarify. We are not saying that an amount over the policy limits is per se unreasonable in the offer. We are not saying that it is per se reasonable to reject that. It ought to be a factor that is considered in whether or not it is unreasonable. I think that you could ameliorate the concerns if you had greater transparency in the offer and acceptance process. This is the offer, plaintiff may say, if it is actually paid. But if it's not actually paid, then I will continue with the litigation. But here's the other thing. I think this court could clarify that
transparency you speak of, though, from whose standpoint? Plaintiffs or defense?
I think both. I think in either case, if I am a defendant and I am extending an offer to the plaintiff, that plaintiff is put in a precarious position, and plaintiff's counsel then they go back to plaintiff to say, now here is your supposed burden of hand. You can take it now and you go to trial. Although I can't even tell you whether or not it's an actual burden of hand, because you could accept this and then they could just say, okay, well, you have a judgment, and commence with execution. And there the plaintiff has neither the cash that they were expecting to end their case shortly, nor do they have the prospect of going after the judgment that the evidence might support. But I think this court, if this court wanted to say the rule of 68, the text of it does not require that, nor does the text of the statute, this court could clarify that those are separate notions, that the spirit of settlement does not supersede the clear language of 68 that does not make that a requirement. Everybody will be on fair warning. Everyone will know that settlement is nice, but that's not what Rule 68 means. And when there is clarity on that point, then I think the penalties would be appropriate.
Great. Thank you very much. We used up some of your time with the questions, so we'll give you 2 minutes in rebuttal. You have about 45 seconds, but we'll extend that to 2 minutes. Mr. Gans, we'll add another minute to your time, so you have 16 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Adam Gans on behalf of the plaintiff, John Berry. Mr. Poulsenberg made an interesting point. He doesn't always win. but you only get paid. That's the difference. That's the difference. This is contingent. This is contingent. I still haven't been paid.
Don't open the door for Mr. Schultz.
My point is exactly that. They're saying this is not contingent, but yet it is. It's not contingent for the defense, and they're talking about a lodestar figure that they believe to be the only way that you should compensate a plaintiff for having and being forced to go through litigation and not giving them their contingency fee. Now, that in itself is unfair to the plaintiffs. Let me tell you why. A plaintiff is still going to pay 45%, even in this case, of any fees that we are entitled to, of any judgment that we collect. Never can a lodestar figure ever compensate a plaintiff for being forced to go all the way through trial for 4 years. This particular case, they talk about the fact that it should be a factor that the judge considered. In this case, the judge specifically found in her order, the language is, while this court appreciates the defendant's position, the availability of insurance should not have been the only factor considered when rejecting an offer of judgment. She did consider that as one of her factors in determining whether or not a fee award should be given in this case. But with regards to the contingency fee, they want you to make a per se rule that you cannot give it in an offer of judgment setting. The problem with that is very, very simple in this case. Let me tell you why it's simple in this case. The offer of judgment was done 3 months after the complaint was filed. 3 months after the complaint was filed in a case that lasted almost 4.5 years. 3 months after the complaint was filed. The complaint was filed on August 22, 2006. The defendant answered in September 22, 2006. The only thing that occurred from that point until the offer of judgment was a request for exemption from arbitration. The offer of judgment was done in December of 2006.
Well, let me ask you this. Assuming it was even that early in the case and probably the amount of work you had into it probably wasn't that much at that stage of the case, since this is an offer of judgment, wouldn't you have to take into some consideration of the timing, meaning that they had the 10 days after you made the offer of judgment to accept it, and shouldn't there be maybe some adjustment of the contingency fee based upon that?
There was in this case, Judge.
Okay.
My fee was a 45% fee. I asked the judge to compensate us for 45% of the judgment. She reduced that to 40%. That was a $140,000 reduction that she made in order to deal with that period of time. Now, she doesn't delineate it specifically, that's what it was for, but she says that the offer of judgment was done in December, and that's what she's going to be giving her fee based on, and she did cut that down. She cut it down by 5%. The argument, of course, is that she didn't specifically delineate that 5% was for the period of time pre-offer. The problem with that, Judge, is that you never asked and never required that the district court specifically delineate all of her reasoning. All you asked to do is that she considers that. She talks about the offers of judgment. She was presented not only contingency fee ways to compensate the plaintiff for the fee in this case, but also the lodestar. They're both talked about. They're both discussed not only on the record. They're both discussed in the argument. They're both discussed in the judge's order. She considered those, and that's all you've ever asked the district court to do. You do not want to substitute your opinions for what a reasonable fee should be, because you'd be in the business of doing fees on everything. I guarantee you there is no fee award that we can't find some problem with based upon the lack of a specific delineation. And that's not the business that you've said in the past that you want to be in. And in this particular case, she took all that into consideration, wrote her own 15-page order on this specific issue, and outlined every single Bonzel factor, every single one of them. And she gave reasoning about every single one of them. And that's all you've ever asked that the district court do. Now, with regards to specifically giving a percentage versus a lodestar, not every case is appropriate for that. And if there were a rule that you have to give a percentage in a personal injury setting where there's an offer of judgment that's beat, I would say you're absolutely right. That is unfair. But that's not what the rule is, that's not what the law is, and that's not what was done here. She probably doesn't give a percentage on every single case. She took into consideration on this case whether or not this case was appropriate for that, considering several things. First of all, the timing of the offer of judgment. It was done at a period of time to avoid 4 years of litigation. I sit down with my clients, I tell them, I need you to give me the lowest number that you want in order for me to do an offer of judgment. And the reason why I do that is because if they don't accept it, I want to make sure that they're going to have to pay for the time and effort that you're going to be involved in this litigation for the next 4 years. And that's what we need to send the message. You want to send a message to the bar, that's the message you should send. You want to offer judgments to be actually effective, send one out and tell them that, yeah, you may actually have to pay their contingency fee in those situations. If you tell them no, you're never going to pay a contingency fee, and you only can give a lodestar figure, there is no reason for defendants not to take a risk and go ahead and continue on. We could have very easily resolved this case 3 months into litigation for a reasonable value that clearly we beat and knew that we were going to beat at that amount, and we only did it with the risk of knowing that they could accept it, knowing that we didn't want to litigate for 4 years. They chose not to, and this court has said in Dillard and in Wynn and in Albios that an offer of judgment of this type of nature is to punish the defendant for forcing the litigation. And that's exactly what this judge determined this case needed to do in order to make sure the defendants know that they should take reasonable offers and not waste everybody's time for 4 years in having to deal with that. They could have taken judgment. We could have started our collection process. Turns out the collection process actually might have been effective at that period of time, but it was used in order to push and delay this, where all our assets turned out not to be around by the time we actually did go to trial. And that's what this was used for. The defense talks about, and the appellate talks about, more specifically, whether or not it was grossly unreasonable to accept, and they want you to say, apparently now, that it's not in every case per se that you cannot offer above the policy. And that's, of course, that makes sense. We don't want that slippery slope. We don't want to sit there and have a trial judge that have to evaluate every single wealth of every single defendant to determine whether or not an offer of judgment is valid. In addition, this court has already actually determined that offers of judgment above policy limits are valid. The Allstate versus Miller case that was talked about at the trial level wasn't referenced in any of the briefs, but the Allstate versus Miller case specifically said they have a duty to take any offers that are above policy limits to their insured specifically to see if they wanted to pay those. And if not, it was a bad thing. Mm-hmm. And you've already determined that offers of judgment above policy limits are valid by saying that. You didn't have any analysis whatsoever to say that you shouldn't be able to do that. And of course, it's nonsensical, because what happens if I decide to go out tomorrow, which your opinion may actually, if it says that you don't have to, you cannot do an offer of judgment above policy limits, I may go reduce my limits to $15,000 tomorrow. Why not? What's the difference? I only offer to settle for $15,000 if I go out and kill somebody. It's a bad message to send. In addition, I think the most telling argument is Justice Douglas' point that this issue with regards to whether or not a contingency fee should be given in offer judgment settings, that was not raised at the time of the district court level. As a matter of fact, they talked about it in the brief for the very first time. They said, well, it's kind of talked about the fact that we said the fee was too much. But the reality is they never specifically said you should not give an offer of judgment, or you should not give a percentage in a Rule 68 or NRCP 17-115 case. They never said that until they got into the briefs. That issue was raised. And I don't want you to take that position, because there was a plethora of facts in this case to indicate that an offer of judgment and contingency fee is appropriate. Not appropriate in every case, but certainly appropriate in some cases. And there was no better facts to be able to send that message that offers of judgment are serious and they have teeth than it is in this case. And certainly, obviously, the issue with regards to the interest, I presume you don't want to hear on. They've now apparently waived that issue, and I think that's probably appropriate. But I guess the only other thing I can say is that if she had started with a contingency fee and ended with a contingency fee and said, I'm only going to consider a contingency fee, then I believe that would be abuse of discretion. But you've said time and again that it's only abuse of discretion in awarding fees, and you're not going to substitute your opinion for those, even if it is a big number.
What about the amount, the percentage of the contingency fee? Is that part of the calculus in this? I don't know, some cases are a third, some are on TV, they advertise for, I don't know, different rates. I haven't kept track of it, but they're kind of bored, and I realize it is a complex case and liability issues, concerns, you probably get a higher contingency fee and all like that. But what's your thoughts on that? And if you chose to do an opinion on this to address the issues raised by other parties, how should we address the percentage issue?
My thoughts are, you want the district court to be able to weigh those factors. She doesn't have to give a full fee. She doesn't have to give what is reasonable and customary in the community, but she can give what's appropriate in that case, and that's what she did in this particular case, and that's what I believe an award of percentage should be based upon, just like it was in the Beezer case, where they reduced it to 25%. I believe even Haley, the judge, Michael Haley, that was the contingency fee that was reduced down to 25% because the judge said that the attorneys made mistakes, they weren't familiar with medical malpractice claims and issues and so on and so forth. So she reduced their fee down to 25%, and this court upheld that and said that was the reasonable. However, you said that she needs to go through the analysis and make sure that they're taking all of these considerations. That's exactly what this judge did in this case. She went through every single Gonzalez factor, and she found in favor of us and felt that the defendant forced and pushed litigation when they could have avoided it, and she based her decision upon the language that I used in argument, as well as the case law from, again, from Dillard and I believe even Albios, where they are intended to punish for forcing people to go through litigation. I think that's the message that needs to be sent. As far as the actual amount goes, I don't think that you should have a blanket set amount and say this is too much and this is too little. I think that is a discretion that is included already within the Brunzell factors. When the court is presented with a fee amount, that a fee request, the court is tasked with determining what a reasonable fee is based upon what is being requested. And I think that would be included with that, Your Honor. And if there weren't any other questions, I think that I'd just like to end by saying that had this district court not gone through with such great detail and gone through every single factor of Beatty and every single factor of Gonzalez, and if the facts of this case were different, if we had done this 10 days beforehand, before a trial, if we had done this on offer of judgment 10 days, that was a good argument I thought they made in the briefs. What happens if you do this 10 days beforehand? If we had done that and she'd given us a full fee for that, then I would say that that would be an abuse of discretion. But certainly, you have to give the deference to the trial court in determining what period of time is reasonable and what's not. A contingency fee 10 days beforehand may never be. But you don't have to put a blanket rule that says a contingency fee is not ever allowed to a plaintiff who is suffering those damages by actually going through a litigation for the years that they force you to do. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Mr. Henry,
we have tremendous respect for the district court in this case, and for the district court in general, for Judge Johnson in particular. And her order was low, but it did not in any respect say why she was discounting the percentage rate that was being asked for. She did expressly explain, the court did explain, why it was granting 40% in particular, and that's because 40% is the market rate in Clark County for personal injury cases. So that was why there was no analysis on why it was being reduced or if it was being reduced. And I think this court asks for more than just some indicia of consideration in the length of an order. It asks for purposes of appellate review for actual reasons. The court did mention that it was rejecting the idea that just because the offer was over the policy limits, that it was unreasonable. But again, that wasn't our argument then. It's not our argument now. It's not a per se argument that we are making. It's that this ought to be a legitimate consideration, at least as long as there is authority saying that the purpose of this is settlement.
Did you, what about the issue Mr. Gantz says you didn't preserve in district court? What's your position on that?
We argued strenuously for a lodestar approach. We said that the contingency fee was inappropriate. It was not as clearly stated as I'm saying it right now that in no case is it ever going to be appropriate. No, we did not say that. I don't think that we needed to say that under Western Technologies, Inc. versus All American. We can, when this court is considering greater public policy ramifications and a scope of an order that goes to make Nevada law, appellants, I think, are not just able but are required to expand on those reasons and authorities in order to inform this court. There was reference to skirting off of assets. There is no finding. There was an allegation that has been thrown around. There was no finding of that from the district court. There was no mention of that from the district court. There was evidence in the record that there was a bankruptcy. And there was a bankruptcy. It is not a mere allegation that he did not have over $300,000 to contribute to this. And so I think as long as it is unclear that payment or the intent to pay has nothing to do with this calculation, it cannot be deemed grossly unreasonable to think that that is important. Yes, the offer of judgment rule should have teeth. And those teeth should be seen as equally long and sharp to both parties. There's a lot of rhetoric about scaring defendants into settling, but this is only a fair rule if it is predictable for both sides. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you again for your briefs and excellent briefs and arguments. And the court will take this case under submission.